Autonomous cars can learn how to drive more smoothly and navigate using local landmarks thanks to human intelligence. To find out more about how Hitachi is harnessing a different kind of AI, head to wired.uk/Hitachi Vehicles. Coming up today, Matt Reynolds delves into the origins of the UK COVID variant, Natasha looks at how Amazon saved delivery from disaster, and Amit charts the strange demise of Habbo Hotel. Welcome to the Wired UK podcast, your essential weekly catch-up on all the big stories in tech, science, business and culture. I'm your host, James Templeton, and joining me this week are Natasha Bernal.
Hello.
Matt Reynolds.
Hello.
And Amit Katwala.
Hi.
This was the week when Joe Biden paused legal action against TikTok and WeChat, which would likely have seen the apps banned in the United States. The Biden administration may also unpick the messy deal that would have seen TikTok's US assets taken over by enterprise software giant Oracle and supermarket chain Walmart.
This week, the founder of dating app Bumble has become the youngest female chief executive to take a company public. Whitney Wolf Heard became a billionaire on Thursday when her shares in her company jumped 77% as they opened on Wall Street and valued her company at $14.5 billion.
This was also the week when the United Arab Emirates became the fifth entity to put a probe into orbit around Mars after the US, the Soviet Union, Europe and India. The HOPE satellite carries three instruments that will observe atoms of hydrogen and oxygen, remnants from water that was once abundant on the planet, as they leak into space.
And it was finally the week when we found out that pigs can be trained to play computer games. So researchers at Purdue University in the US trained pigs to move a joystick to make a cursor bump into walls on a computer screen. When the cursor bumped into a wall, the pigs got treats. They weren't as good at the game as rhesus monkeys, however, which might be because the pigs couldn't see the screen and the joystick at the same time.
Apparently, the pigs continued to play the game after the treats were taken away, which would suggest they were getting some sort of joy out of it anyway, or they were just impatient and wanted more treats that weren't coming.
I also read that some of the pigs got too big to play the game because the enclosure was the wrong size. The whole experiment went on for 15 months, and I felt quite sad for those pigs that maybe just watched while their fellow pigs, you know, played the fun game.
So pigs spending the last 15 months in a small room eating too much and playing video games. Sounds relatable. What did we learn this week? Amit, let's start with you.
I learned an interesting fact about commuting, which is obviously very relatable too. I learned about Marchetti's constant, which states that the average commuting time remains constant at about an hour a day, regardless of what technological improvements have happened. So inventions like bicycles, trains and cars haven't shortened our commutes. We've simply started living further and further from work. So the average daily commute today is the same as it was in the 15th century, for instance.
So in the 15th century, I would have lived an hour's walk away or an hour's
horse
away.
Yeah, or like an hour's horse. Yeah, exactly. An hour's horseback ride, an hour's raft, you know, raft trip, whatever it might be. But as technology improves, we've just commuted to, our commutes have just gotten longer in miles to compensate. Although, of course, now my commute is about 0.2 seconds and 1 foot. So maybe this lockdown has broken Marchetti's constant.
It's done something good. What did you learn this week, Natasha?
So I rewatched The Wizard of Oz earlier this week, and I don't know if you remember this, but there's a bit where the Wicked Witch of the West conjures up a poppy field to stop Dorothy and her companions from getting to the Emerald City. Now, Dorothy and the lion fall asleep, and they succumb to the vapours that are released by the poppies. Now, we know that smelling poppies alone is not alone, and it's not enough to bring on sleep because the active components aren't volatile. So Dorothy and the lion would have had to have basically sat down and eaten all the poppies in the poppy field to become high and then potentially die of an overdose. But this week I discovered, because I was Googling this, I was like, well, what would actually kill you? I discovered that a home brewing technique used to extract morphine from unwashed poppy seeds can kill you, can produce lethal doses of the drug opium, and has killed a bunch of people as they were looking to get high. So poppy seed bagels are fine, poppy seed tea is not good, and The Wizard of Oz is factually incorrect. That's what I learned.
Very good. Amit, what did... No, Amit, we've already done you, I beg your pardon. Matt Reynolds, what did you learn this week?
I learned that the word algorithm comes from the name of a Persian mathematician called Muhammad ibn Musa al-Khwarizmi, who was born in the 8th century AD. So he wrote a book that was really, really influential into introducing Hindu-Arabic numerals to Europe. So that's basically the number system we have now. It replaced the Latin-Roman way of writing numbers. Now, when his name was Latinized for a translation of his book centuries after his death, it became algorithmi, which is the origin of the word algorithm.
Didn't we have the origin of the word robot on last week?
Yeah.
Good. No, this is a good trend. Yeah, more etymology facts. I learned this week, courtesy of the BBC radio programme, More or Less, what would happen if you collected together all of the SARS-CoV-2 particles in the world since the pandemic began. So the question was, how big would all of that stuff be? And the answer is about 160 millilitres, which is enough to fill 6 shot glasses. Now, even that's a conservative estimate, but you go up to the higher end of the scale and you still wouldn't have enough to fill a Coke can. So all of the death, all of the destruction is 6 shots of very, very deadly stuff. A cheerful thought. Our first story this week follows on quite nicely from that, Matt Reynolds. You've been delving deep into the origins of the UK variant.
Yeah, I've been thinking about where some of that Coke can filling virus came from. This is all about the UK variant, which I first heard about, I think, along with a lot of people on December 14th. And this is when Matt Hancock, the UK Health Secretary, made quite a scary announcement in Parliament. And he talked about a new variant of SARS-CoV-2, which is the virus that causes COVID-19. He said there was a new variant that might be causing increased transmission in Southeast England. Now, this is quite alarming at the time, but like a lot of people, we'd heard a lot about mutations and the potential of mutations, but so far, no mutation really caused a change in the course of the pandemic in a significant way. Now, it became clear very quickly that things with the UK variant were different. So this variant is officially called B117, which is a bit of a boring name, but we'll just call it the UK variant. Now, it's up to 70% more transmissible than other variants, and it quickly started making up the majority of new cases in Southeast England. So it became very clear that we couldn't ignore this new variant like we'd ignored talk of other mutations in the past. Now it's pretty much everywhere. So it's been found in 75 countries. It's spreading locally in Brazil, in Canada, China, the United States, and most of Europe. And preliminary data also suggests that the new variant may be around 30% more deadly than other circulating variants. And on top of that, a little bit later down the line, the variant has acquired some of the mutations that help it evade the body's immune response. But what was strange about the UK variant is that it really surprised scientists in more ways than just how transmissible it was and just how it kind of took over in terms of the UK composition of cases. What was different about it is it was genetically quite distinct from other SARS-CoV-2 viruses that were circulating in the UK. And it suggested that this particular variant had a very, very specific origin story evolving in just one person.
Viruses obviously mutate all the time as a function of, you know, the way they replicate. What was it about the UK variant that made it so remarkable? You know, there were hundreds or thousands of other variants by that point, so why was this one getting so much attention?
So to realise why the UK variant stuck out so much, you kind of need to know, like you said, Amit, about what the virus does normally. And what we already know about SARS-CoV-2 is that it's a genetic slowpoke, really. So viruses, they acquire mutations because they have little errors in their genetic code when they make copies of themselves. Now, coronaviruses are quite a clever type of virus that basically has proteins that reduce the number of mistakes they make. So they're actually slower at acquiring these mutations than other types of viruses. Now, to put that into some numbers, SARS-CoV-2 tends to pick up 1 or 2 mutations per month in a genome that contains 30,000 letters. So out of all of those letters, almost all of them are the same, you know, a month later, except maybe one. So these are really, really small changes that happen over pretty long amounts of time. Now, the UK variant was odd because it had 17 changes and they all appeared in one go. And even more worryingly, 8 of those changes were in the spike protein, and that's the part of the virus that helps it latch on and get into cells. So rather than one mutation appearing at a time, we had a bunch of quite serious and potentially quite impactful mutations that happened all at the same time. Now, we know how the virus mutates, and we could see this UK variant emerging because the UK sequences the genomes of about 10% of all its positive COVID-19 swab tests. So that's more than any other country. So usually we can watch these viruses slowly changing over time, and we can see a variant become slightly more popular and then not catch on. But what we saw with B.1.1.7 is that it was different, and then, you know, we first saw it in September, and it really, really, you know, expanded quite quickly after that. So the first UK variant sample dated back from September the 20th, and then we got one a day later from September the 21st. And at the time, it stuck out as really, really different from the other viruses circulating. But it's important to point out that, Amit, like you said, there's hundreds of thousands of genetic variants of SARS-CoV-2. I mean, James, you talked about how many different virus particles there are to fill that Coke can. I think within one person infected, they have about a billion virus particles. And each of those, you know, might be genetically distinct. Well, not each of them, but there's a huge array of genetic distinctness within them. So really, one virus or one sample being different doesn't really ring any alarm bells, right? It's one difference in thousands, about 10,000 sequences that they're seeing each week. But what became a real issue with the UK variant is that later through November and then in early December, Public Health England realised that cases were rising really sharply in Kent despite lockdown measures. And that's when we looked back at the genetic data and said, OK, there's something going on with this variant. This is what's driving it. And this is why this is a variant we should really be worried about.
You mentioned an origin story that it could be traced back to one person, basically, all these cases back to one single source. So what evidence is there of this?
So there are three possible origin stories for the UK variant, and I'm just going to go through them quickly. So one is that the virus mutated abroad and it had only been detected once it entered the UK. So that's because, as I said before, the UK sequences way more genomes than pretty much anywhere else in the world. You know, other countries like Denmark, they might sequence a couple of percent, but lots of places barely sequence any genomes. So if a variant arose there, we just might not see about it. So one hypothesis is it happened somewhere else and then it came to the UK and, you know, that's where we first notice it. Now, scientists think that's probably not what happened, because most of the places that saw the spread of the UK variant after it had been identified in the UK had very strong travel links to the UK, which suggests that it originated there. Now, a second possibility is that variant emerged through something called recombination. And viruses can do this quite clever thing with their genomes, as well as acquiring mutations just as they replicate and they, they replicate their genetic code. They can also swap their genomes with other viruses next to them. It's a bit like, I don't know, me going to you, Natasha, and saying, oh, I don't know, I love your genome for brown eyes. Let me grab that and let me use that for myself. So viruses can do that, and that can mean they can take quite big genetic jumps in one go. But because we're doing all this tracing in the UK, you should be able to see where those genetic changes might have come from. And you can say, point to this virus and say, oh, okay, I see where it took that bit of code from. Now, scientists in the UK just couldn't see any of these ancestors. And that really left one likely remaining hypothesis, and that's that the UK variant emerged from just one person infected with COVID-19 for probably quite a long time.
Now, we've got millions of people all around the world that have been infected with this virus. We may never know the true number. How can it be that in one person it evolves so differently? Should it not be evolving this quickly in all of us? What makes one individual so different?
Yeah, well, I mean, you're totally right, James. I think the WHO has said there's about 106 million confirmed cases of COVID-19 that have been since the start of the pandemic. There's likely, you know, many times more than that. And that's obviously 106 million chances or people within which the virus can evolve. And it's true, there's been a huge amount of mutation that happens on a kind of population level. But actually, we know quite well that viruses can also stay within individual people for really long amounts of time and evolve within one person. So there's, you know, a whole history of this happening with different viruses. So, for instance, we know that Ebola virus RNA has been detected in the semen of men a year after they first recovered from the virus. Some people stay infected with norovirus, which is a really common stomach bug that causes vomiting and diarrhea. Some people are infected with that for more than 6 months. There's actually a man in the UK that has excreted infectious polio virus for at least 28 years. And the virus within him is genetically distinct from other types of poliovirus that are circulating. Now, these chronic infections usually happen in people who are immunocompromised or immunosuppressed. So their immune systems can't fully clear a viral infection. But what they do is they keep beating it up for weeks on end. And what that does is that puts evolutionary pressure on the virus to adopt new forms. So they never fully clear that virus, but they reduce the population down to a slightly genetically different subset of virus, and that virus can kind of take hold. And it's really the process that causes evolution across a much wider scale, across a whole planet or within a population, but happening within one person, kind of accelerated evolution.
I guess it's similar to what we see with antibiotics sometimes, where that's why doctors always tell you to finish the course of antibiotics, because if you don't, then you basically put evolutionary pressure on the bacteria, and the ones that are left will evolve to kind of evade those antibiotics. But is this something that we've seen with the coronavirus in this case as well?
Yeah, absolutely. So there are multiple documented cases of people with chronic COVID-19 infection. So the usual COVID-19 infection, you might stay infectious for 10 days. And after that, the virus is more or less cleared. You're not going to shed any more active virus. In really severe cases, you might stay infected for 20 days. That's pretty rare. But for some people, and in pretty exceptional cases, you might be infected for months at a time. So there was one case, was a man with cancer of the lymph nodes who had gone through chemotherapy, and he was infected for 102 days before sadly dying. And basically what scientists can do is they can look at how the virus is changing within one person that's had the virus for a really long amount of time. So this man was treated with blood plasma from a recovered COVID-19 patient at day 63 of his illness, and that blood plasma contains antibodies that they hope will kind of attack the virus kind of on the person's behalf, right? You're basically bolstering your immune response. And now what they saw, after they were treated with that blood plasma, is that the genetic makeup of the SARS-CoV-2 virus within that person started to shift. So by day 82, the viruses with this six-letter deletion in the spike gene were now the dominant population. Now that deletion, which is called Delta H69/V70 Delta, which basically means that two amino acids have changed in the genetic sequence of the virus. They think that seems to be partly behind the increased transmission of the UK variant. Basically, what it does is it changes the shape of the very end of the spike protein to make it easier for it to latch onto host cells. So we can see that within someone that was chronically infected and had blood plasma, that the virus ended up changing into this more transmissible form. It seems that there's this pressure that made the virus evolve into this form. And actually, we've seen that in another case. That same mutation was found in another chronically infected patient, a 47-year-old woman who was admitted to hospital in St. Petersburg, who'd been ill for more than 4 months. Now, we've seen this not only in these two patients, but we've seen these genetic changes in other chronically ill patients who continue to shed virus over the course of their infection. They tot up maybe 8, maybe 15 genetic changes that, kind of build on top of each other. And although we don't know for sure whether this was the origin of the UK variant, scientists think it's the most likely hypothesis we've got at the moment.
Two things come to mind. One, this should finally skewer any notion of herd immunity, right? That everyone catching this virus will eventually lead to it having no one new to infect. This virus will find people in which it can really, really rapidly evolve and become potentially far more dangerous. And the second thing would be we have a partially, in the UK, we have a partially vaccinated population. So there's over 13 million people who have had one dose of a COVID-19 vaccine. And the longer this pandemic remains out of control under those kind of circumstances, the more chance there is of these sort of situations happening, because you're effectively creating a gymnasium for the virus to get really, really hench, right? So what can we do about it, given the sheer number of cases that are still rolling all around the world?
Yeah, so there are a couple of directions that this single chronic infection hypothesis might lead you towards. Now, one is that we need to be doing more to track and understand how the virus mutates within chronically ill people. Now, in an ideal world, that might be checking who is shedding virus for a really long period of time. As I said, most people shed virus for 10 days and that's it. But we're not entirely sure why some people are long-term shedders, and we're not very good at identifying them. So it might be a case of trying to identify these people and then sequencing them over time to see what's happening. It also might mean limiting the use of blood plasma, which is that treatment I said that seemed to provoke those genetic changes in that patient I spoke about earlier, we might want to limit the use of convalescent plasma to cases where severely immunosuppressed patients could be isolated and monitored. If this leads to genetic changes, then we want to minimise the chance that there'll be this escape. But really, and you touched on this, James, the real problem isn't chronic infection. It's not about, making sure it never gets in. Well, it is making sure that it never gets in these people, but it's not about, the people that get the virus. In fact, around 2.7% of the US population is immunosuppressed in some way. So it's actually a pretty big chunk of people. What it is about is a situation where the pandemic is so out of control that the virus has endless opportunities to mutate into new variants. So really, the chance that the UK variant would, come into existence is pretty rare. But if you've got millions of new infections in, however many tens of thousands of people a day, well, those rare edge cases are going to come up all the time. And that situation was a reality in the UK, back in September and all the way through to December and into early January, and in dozens of other countries with dangerously high case rates. So really, stopping the emergence of new variants means doing more of what we know stops transmission. So it means wearing face masks, it means social distancing, it means working from home and doing better at tracing infections. And like you said, James, although we've got really promising data that vaccines are a super powerful tool for stopping hospitalizations and infections alone, or serious illness at least alone, they are no defense against the emergence of new variants. And some of the epidemiologists I spoke to said that if we have this really widespread transmission in a partially vaccinated population, that might apply some evolutionary pressure that might select for vaccine resistant or variants that can escape from our immune response. We might have seen that already in the Brazilian variant in a population that had quite high natural immunity because of acquired infection. And this is really the point. There does not seem to be an alternative to getting transmission down. So this is kind of the answer that no one wants to hear. Vaccines are helping us. They're a really powerful tool. They'll stop illnesses and they're good against the variants we have now for the most part. But there isn't, much of a better answer than just getting transmission down. That's kind of the key to this whole thing.
And so the question that we might be asking people down the pub once the pub is legal again in who knows how long is, how many vaccines have you had? Have you had your sixth dose yet? So this sort of game of cat and mouse of lockdowns and restrictions and social distancing and vaccine after vaccine after vaccine to sort of back the coronavirus into a corner from which it can't escape.
Yeah, exactly. And it's worth noting that genomic surveillance is a really powerful tool in this. The quicker that we can, see the new genomes of these variants and also know what difference that makes, because there are so many changes. Like Amit said, there are so many different genetic varieties of this, but we don't exactly know what a change in that gene means versus a change in that gene. If we can characterize these more quickly, then we can kind of make better guesses of how our vaccines might respond and how tweaked vaccines might respond to those as well. So it also really underlines that this genomic surveillance, which is one thing the UK has actually done pretty well throughout the entire pandemic, is going to become really, really important throughout the future, because it's going to inform our public health response and also perhaps, how we use vaccines as well. So genomic surveillance has got quite a big part to play in this as well.
It's such an interesting and important story, and it might not feel like it, but there's a lot of detail that we didn't have time to bring on to the podcast. So do go and track down the link in the show notes and read it in full. podcast@wired.co.uk with your thoughts on that or anything else that we talk about in the show this week. Natasha, this week you've been looking into Deliveroo. It's a company that listeners to the podcast have maybe spent a lot more money on over the last few months, but it turns out it hasn't been doing so well.
Yeah, so the past 10 months or so have been absolutely extraordinary for Deliveroo. At the start of the pandemic in March 2020, it said it was close to complete financial ruin. Now it's gearing up for a London blockbuster IPO that could value the company at up to £8 billion. It's had a remarkable comeback from bust to boom. And this week I decided to take a closer look at how it did this.
Now, I have to say, Natasha, until I read your piece, I didn't quite realise how on the ropes Deliveroo was. I'm an occasional user. I certainly, you know, I know you go into restaurants, there's loads of delivery drivers outside. You seem to see them everywhere. But back in March, there was this news that Deliveroo was in pretty serious financial trouble and it seemed to come out of nowhere. So, you know, what happened? What had gone wrong? And how serious were things?
Yeah, so Deliveroo, you're right, complete darling of the London tech scene, growing really quickly. Before that time in March 2020, it was in quite rude health, really. It was a growing startup. It had, you know, cash flow of around 230 million. It was growing. It had operational costs, but it was doing quite well for itself. Now, when the lockdown began, I don't know if you guys remember this, but there was a whole scare about whether takeaways were safe. People were afraid of you know, going to their local restaurants. There was a lot of uncertainty as to how the virus was communicated. People were thinking it was through touch. It wasn't very clear what the rules should be, and there was a lot of uncertainty. So when that first lockdown in the UK began in March 2020, Deliveroo was really the worst prepared of the three major takeaway players in the UK. Its biggest draws were brands such as KFC, Burger King and Wagamama that were forced to basically shut down from night till day. You know, it was one of those really abrupt, we have to stop operating, we're closing down all of our restaurants, and that supply just completely fell out from underneath them. So they didn't have the backing from big chain takeaways, and Deliveroo didn't have Uber Eats resources or Just Eat's roster of local restaurants to plug that gap. So it suddenly found itself without a lot of the revenue that it would have normally used to kind of keep on spending, keep on growing as it had been doing up until that point. Now, salvation was within reach in the form of a £575 million investment, which had been led by e-commerce giant Amazon the previous year. But that deal had been blocked by the competition watchdog for almost a year. With a decision scheduled for July 2020 and an uncertain outcome, Deliveroo was strapped for cash and had nowhere to turn. So its only option at that time was to talk to the competition watchdog, the Competition and Markets Authority, to ask it to release its grip over the deal. Now, the information we heard in March came completely out of the blue. It was very unusual for the CMA to make an announcement saying that Deliveroo had admitted that operating conditions had changed so dramatically that it could not continue to function and would have to exit the market if the CMA did not approve the investment led by Amazon. Now, if you look at what was happening behind the scenes, which I did this week, you could see just how dramatic this change was, because that inquiry from the CMA had not really been going that smoothly. When it first launched in 2019, the CMA was really worried. It basically elbowed its way in to make sure that Amazon's well-lined purse and logistics expertise wouldn't basically destroy the competition in the market for takeaway deliveries. Now, I don't know if you remember this, but Amazon had launched its own restaurants business globally a few years prior to this, and it had failed. So it decided to withdraw from the market. And this new investment was a huge concern to the competition watchdog, because it thought this was a chance for basically Amazon to potentially disrupt competition in a very precarious market. For them, it didn't really matter that Amazon wasn't buying Deliveroo outright. It was basically a 16% stake in the business, what Amazon was getting in exchange for its investment. It was the fact that it had previous experience in the restaurant takeaway business that had caught the attention of the regulator. So the CMA looked at the deal, realised it would give Amazon a board seat, and Amazon would be able to see the strategy of the company, something that it considered would impact competition. So it decided to put a halt on the deal and extend its investigation, which had already gone on since July 2019, to examine the market in a more profound phase two review.
I mean, we're kind of in a situation where both Amazon and Deliveroo kind of got what they wanted in the end, right? You know what I mean? Like, the cynic in me is like, oh, how convenient. At a time when people are getting more takeaways than ever, you're suddenly in financial straits and you have to get this £575 million investment from Amazon. Well, what are the odds? I mean, why did the CMA decide to change its mind?
Yes, it's a weird thing, isn't it, when you look back on it, because we know what happened afterwards, which was a huge bump in delivery activity and how well Deliveroo has done since then. But in that short space of time, which was really equivalent to just a few weeks, by March 17th, when Deliveroo got in touch with the CMA, we didn't know what was going to happen next. It basically had done this sort of preliminary investigation, was basically ready to give its preliminary decisions on its second phase investigation into the deal. And it had not gone smoothly, really. It basically was saying that Amazon was not being very forthcoming with information. It had sent a £55,000 penalty notice to Amazon because it had not delivered 189 documents that it had been asking for. It basically delayed for between a few days and 2 months later to provide these documents. So the CMA was not happy, really, necessarily, with the way things were going at the point when it found out that Deliveroo was failing. Now, when that happened, everything that it thought, basically, it had to go back to the drawing board. Deliveroo used a defence called the failing firm defence, which is not very usual. It essentially means that the company has to prove that it cannot raise any funds from anywhere else, and there is no other option but the deal that the CMA has to approve. So for Deliveroo to survive, the CMA had to agree the company had no alternative. So no other investors were prepared to step in. No other money could be found anywhere else. And the fact that Deliveroo would be allowed to fail would have been a worse outcome than to save it. So basically, the CMA had to go, right, is it better for Deliveroo to fail? No. Is it better? Can Deliveroo find any other money from any other place? No. So therefore, what is the best outcome? And it decided finally that Amazon was the best outcome. It had to do an extensive analysis of internal documents from Amazon and Deliveroo alongside a survey of over 3,000 of its customers, submissions from interested third parties, and it had the power to ask for things like minutes from board meetings, details of companies' cash flow, access to financial advisors. So all sorts of information it had to do to basically do in the space of a few weeks what it normally would have liked to have done in the space of a year. So if Deliveroo was really on the verge of collapse, the CMA had resolved to find the cause. And in the end, what we found in March in its preliminary decision was that its only option was to usher the deal through.
It's an incredible turnaround, as Amit said. Great news for Amazon and Deliveroo. And very, very quickly after the CMA made its decision, Deliveroo was back in rude health again, and it had this wonderful market in which to run free.
Yeah, it was really great news for the company because you don't really know what the CMA's decision would have been had this situation not occurred. But with the benefit of hindsight, things weren't as dire as what Deliveroo and the CMA, and in fact, everyone else at the time, thought they were. So you're right, James. Just after the deal was approved, Deliveroo started really quickly clawing back its losses and was free to finance dark kitchens and expansion with Amazon's money. Now, physical restaurants remained closed for the better part of the year. The use of delivery apps soared. Deliveroo's major rivals and Deliveroo posted huge gains. So Uber Eats announced a 150% jump in UK deliveries in the 3 months to September. Just Eat, which is the UK market leader by order volumes, said it processed 17 million transactions in October alone, up from 10 million in January 2019. So this is a huge spike in activity. Deliveroo said that in the second and third quarters of 2020, it managed to turn an operating profit. Now, this is extraordinary, bearing in mind that the company said that it could not operate just a few months prior to that. This obviously is a statement that will be subject to greater scrutiny when it starts publishing its investor reports ahead of its potential IPO in April. Now, in January, Deliveroo managed to raise even more money. This is a 180 million funding round from existing investors, as well as new investors, valuing the eight-year-old company at more than $7 billion without including the newly funds raised. So the interesting thing here is it was able to raise more money after the market basically changed. This is a story of how the pandemic really was a key part of the fortunes of a startup company that you'd think would have done really well regardless. But it just shows how things change so quickly. However, when you think about who actually has won from this deal, it's inevitable that you will think of Amazon. If it weren't for the timing of these few weeks, of the pandemic, of the pressure on the CMA, of the CMA's decision that there was no other alternative, perhaps things might not have gone its way. The rush caused by the pandemic has let Amazon muscle in on the restaurant delivery industry again. But this time, it doesn't have any risk to its own business. It's not launching its own restaurant business again. Instead, it's an investor that doesn't have any risk, that can sit on the board and watch what happens to Deliveroo as Deliveroo mucks into the sort of very difficult and competitive business of restaurant takeaway apps. So while Deliveroo obviously benefited from the deal, Amazon is also getting a brilliant return on investment. We spoke to retail analyst at Forrester, Sukarita Kadali, who said that this has given Amazon the opportunity to look under the hood of Deliveroo for basically what is a negligible cost. She argues that Amazon can learn from it to relaunch its own restaurant business or to maneuver into the still relatively untapped market for dark kitchens in other territories. Now, dark kitchens is something that Wider's covered before. It's basically the idea that anyone can cook from anywhere. Restaurants can kind of get rid of the front end where you have your tables, your chairs, your customers, and just have kitchens that can be in any place quite close to where people want to do deliveries and just do deliveries rather than restaurant table service. Now, this is a huge burgeoning business and Deliveroo has pioneered it. After a year of turmoil, Deliveroo is now investing in this again and is going to grow the amount of dark kitchens that it has in this year, doubling actually the number that it will have to 64, I believe. But this is all come at a cost. So this is all potentially going to be a huge opportunity for Amazon. And this is where it becomes a kind of contentious what will happen next, right? Deliveroo could very easily, according to the analysts that we've spoken to, become basically a testing ground for Amazon's wildest takeaway ambitions. Now it's on the board, it can see the strategy, it can take a look to see what Deliveroo is doing well and potentially replicate that in other markets. It no longer really has to figure out how to win the restaurant game, which is going to be battled out basically trying to persuade restaurants to carry on working with them after things have gone back to normal and they no longer solely rely on delivery apps to make ends meet. They're going to have to persuade all these riders to carry on working with them when the market becomes more and more competitive. And they're going to have to battle it out with dark kitchens, which is a market that's going to be potentially worth $71.4 billion by 2027. So this is a really interesting side of the business. And Amazon has gained a front row seat to what happens next. And it would be very interesting to see if it's able to capitalize off of the information that it might be able to gather from Deliveroo to replicate some of it in its own businesses. So Deliveroo has pioneered dark kitchens, but it could be Amazon, the one that truly scales them. So it's a really interesting story, fascinating situation for Deliveroo. And it's a great tale from going from financial ruin to IPO in under a year. I don't think people will forget about that anytime soon.
Deliveroo's done pretty well, even though it seemed very unlikely just a few short months ago. And, you know, Amazon, maybe not intentionally, has already done a very good job of hollowing out high streets up and down the UK and across the world. Something that it hasn't managed to do is hollow out the restaurant business in quite the same way. And if I were to put on Amit's cynical hat, the amount of venture capitalist money and investment money generally that's going to go into the dark kitchens business does risk putting that pressure on restaurants that have traditionally taken up a place in our towns, cities and villages. So your local takeaway might disappear and be replaced by a dark kitchen and an industrial estate just up the motorway. And, you know, that's sort of the long game one would imagine that Amazon might be playing here. It's very good at that side of things. It's not very good at supporting local high streets, or you could certainly argue it isn't anyway. So it will be very interesting to see the discussions that we're having about the knock-on consequences of this deal in a few years' time. podcast@wired.co.uk if you've got any thoughts on that, and we'll include a link to the story in the show notes. Never one to lack variety, we're now going to switch to a bit of a blast from the past, Amit. Habbo Hotel, which I don't think I've heard anyone talk about for about a decade, but you're going to talk about it now.
You should talk to our colleague Alex Lee, who will not shut up about it. Habbo Hotel. Listeners of a certain age might have fond memories of Habbo Hotel, the MMO game / chat room that was really popular about 20 years ago. So I don't know if you guys remember playing this as sort of young adults or teenagers, or younger, I guess. But anyway, you created a character and you could kind of wander around this big virtual isometric hotel and you basically just hang out, right? You chat with your friends, you chat with strangers, you play little mini games. Habbo Hotel was really, really popular around 2000, 2001, 2002, and then kind of fell off a cliff as people that were playing it got older and, you know, games got snazzier and more interactive and just better. But it's had a big resurgence in popularity during lockdown, so a lot of old players returned to the game. The platform's population on Habbo Hotel soared by 213% between late February and late March last year. And the influx of returnees kind of looking for nostalgia revitalized the game's comparatively stagnant economy. But then it all went wrong.
Now, I don't think I ever played Habbo Hotel. I seem to remember playing some kind of Habbo ripoff called like Penguin Palace or something that was like Habbo Hotel, but basically we're penguins. Now, this must have been one of the first games to have a real in-game economy, because now we're quite used to, I don't know, buying skins and trading things and, you know, real money being quite a big part of games. But what was Habbo's economy like?
Yeah, you're right, Matt. This is kind of the model right now for a lot of free games. It's like, you know, the actual game is free and you try and maximize your user base and you make money from getting them to buy little items. And Habbo kind of pioneered this really back in the day. It was one of the first games to allow users to buy and sell items within the game with real money and trade them. And so over the years, they kind of built up this thriving marketplace within the game, where you can kind of buy virtual credits directly from Habbo and accrue them by, you know, completing certain challenges or playing games and turn them back into credits and then buy stuff in the game with those credits. But there was also a black market running parallel to this, so kind of a community of vendors exchanging credits for real-world currencies on Discord servers and digital marketplaces. So you might go there if you wanted to find a better deal, or if you were a trader and you had a lot of stuff in the world of Habbo that you wanted to turn into real-world cash. So this was kind of frequented by a small fraction of the player base, but one that included some of the platform's most trusted players. And what happened was, because we had this resurgence, you know, during lockdown of people coming back into the game, it meant that a lot of items that had been missing for years in these locked in these users' accounts kind of came back into the game. And items kind of, because of the increased population, items shot up in value, you know, in a similar way to like Bitcoin shooting up in value. Like these... And then some players kind of saw their in-game wealth basically doubling. One of the players we spoke to said their in-game wealth literally doubled because all these people came in, their items skyrocketed in value, and the economy was really, really booming.
So, sounds like a bubble. Bubbles tend to pop. Is that what happened?
Yeah, essentially, yes. So, what went wrong was that the game changed. So we've talked, I think, on the podcast before about Adobe Flash, which was phased out towards the end of last year. And so as part of that, Habbo was one of the games that ran on Flash, so they had to kind of update it. And as part of that big update following the removal of Flash, they moved to a game engine called Unity. But the developers, who are called Sulake, also announced a bunch of other changes to the game, so including an end to the bartering system and an end to one-to-one trading. So what that basically did was make black market trading impossible. So it kind of centralized the economy within only official channels. And at the same time, Sulake also introduced tax hikes on in-game items and an 80% wealth tax. So it was essentially like a real-world government shutting down shops and telling business owners that they could only sell their goods in one enormous state-run supermarket. And what that basically did was it crashed the economy of Habbo Hotel. So you had this kind of mad dash, sort of you know, last days vibe as Habbo users rushed to kind of trade in all their kind of items in the game for cash as quickly as possible, which then obviously drove the price further down. And it was this huge kind of like stock market collapse within the world of Habbo Hotel as they attempted to cash out. So one player we spoke to says that they could have made $6,000 from selling their items before the trade-off and ended up salvaging just $1,500 thanks to making a string of last minute deals. And this was all happening in the black market. So in-game, the marketplace was kind of continuing as normal, but the black market prices were crashing as people tried to dump their assets. We're talking thousands and thousands of dollars in potential revenue being lost.
I love this story because, I mean, there's so much to like about this. It's obviously very sad for people who, I mean, I'm a capitalist, so you should be able to make money as best as you can, in my opinion. But it doesn't really make sense. I mean, you've got the situation where everyone's sort of fire selling all of the stuff that they've accumulated, prices are crashing. What is the point of doing that? I mean, if the official store was doing fine, why did the developers make these changes and ruin what seemed to be quite a nice side gig to keep people engaged in the game? Why did they do it?
You'd never see a real country deliberately trash their economy for no reason, would you? So the developers were kind of saying that they wanted the changes to de-incentivize black market trading and make it harder to kind of steal items from hacked accounts. There were a lot of kind of scams and things that were going on beforehand. So, like, you know, the user base was quite young and they were kind of, I guess, more liable to kind of get falling for like scams online. So people were getting scammed out of items on the black market, you know, quite often. So that was a problem. And I guess their rationale was that centralizing the economy around the marketplace would make it safer and kind of help develop selling and trading within the official channels rather than outside of the official channels. So that's what the developers were saying. Cynics would argue that they just wanted to kind of take a cut, right? If you can control the marketplace where everyone buys their stuff, you can charge them a tax and you can kind of take a cut of those transactions and make more money. They kind of, the users that were complaining about this on Twitter said that the changes were financially motivated and they represent a focus on kind of new players that has kind of alienated old players. The problem is that, you know, although these changes were, according to developers, meant to reduce the risk of scams, actually new scams kind of proliferated because you had all these people coming back to the game combined with all these people on the black market kind of desperately trying to dump their assets, and this perfect storm of like quite seasoned traders and gullible newcomers or people who haven't been there for a while. So also what ended up happening was you had these black market traders who had been on the platform for years, you know, decades maybe, and they'd kind of built these reputations as trusted traders on this black market platform, you know, because they did what they said they were going to do. You gave them money, they gave you the items, they didn't try and scam you. But when you know that the marketplace that you're trading on is about to shut down forever, your incentive to be honest and trustworthy completely disappears. So you had these kind of previously trusted traders on the black market suddenly turning evil and like no longer caring about their good reputation and scamming anyone they could because they knew that A, the black market was about to disappear, and B, they probably weren't going to play Habbo ever again. So it's as if, you know, eBay said, we're going to shut down in a month, so all your star ratings no longer matter. And then, but said, you can keep trading for, until the end. And suddenly all the things that were keeping people in line just disappeared.
This is quite a sad story because we have really dedicated players, a small, you know, cabal of dedicated players who have been playing across two decades. And then amazingly, we get all these new players come in and maybe this could be a kind of second wind of the game and maybe it's exciting. And instead, it sounds like the game basically imploded. So what does that mean for the future of Habbo Hotel? Does something emerge from the ashes, a new version that might, you know, these new players might carry forward? Or is this really the death of the game for good?
Yeah, it's not looking great, to be honest. So trading kind of continued into December. In December, Sealec released the open beta for the new version of the game, but it was full of bugs. It didn't go down well. They eventually switched over to the new version on January 12th. The following week, player numbers had dropped by almost 56%. So it's lost a huge number of players already, pretty much losing all the gains that it had made during lockdown and maybe then some. Some loyal players are setting off in search of new land. So Tommy, who's the co-founder of a Habbo official fan site, is launching a new game called Fissio, F-I-S-S-I-O. So kind of making a version of Habbo that kind of takes it back to the good old days, you know, chatting, exploring, socializing. And this is kind of, the update, not only did the update destroy the economy of Habbo, but it also kind of destroyed a lot of the community. And those two things are inextricably linked. And it's a real shame, yeah. So this kind of old game is kind of dying a bit of a death. You know, the hotel's kind of empty, much like hotels in the real world are, and it's all because of this change by the developer that and this bubble that burst and then crashed the economy. But I think it's a really interesting story and a kind of microcosm of what you might see in the real world.
If nobody out there is writing a PhD on this, then they really, really have to. I think the 1,500 or so words that we were able to dedicate to it were ample, but there's so much more to say and probably an awful lot more to learn. You know, if there are chances out there trying to come up with new financial packages to get countries up and running after lockdown, maybe take a look at Habbo Hotel to learn what not to do, right? Very often video games give us interesting examples of what happens when chaos is allowed to reign. Really, really fun story, if a bit depressing in a strange way. Podcast at wired.co.uk. Were you amongst the last days of Habbo Hotel? Did you get scammed or were you scamming? Do get in touch. Podcast at wired.co.uk. A couple of emails in the inbox this week about dogs, Natasha.
Yeah, so Peter and Christopher wrote in about the dog story that we talked about last week, which was about people who were getting lockdown puppies and were being scammed by unscrupulous sellers online. Interesting story. Peter in Australia basically said to, you know, get rescue dog if you can. He got a rescue dog called Socks. that his grandchildren really love. And, you know, yes, you're absolutely right. I think over here in the UK, it's been really difficult to find any kind of rescue dogs because they are very oversubscribed. But yeah, good recommendation there from Peter. And Christopher says that he loves the show. He listens to it every Saturday while he takes his lockdown puppy for a walk. And his puppy's called Hugo. He said that he didn't really want to get a lockdown puppy, but it just ended up being the case. And that he was basically experiencing firsthand what this story was all about. He said that he, when he tried to get a puppy online, that breeders would send him a stock picture of a puppy as proof and request a percentage of the cost of the puppy, which could be up to £3,000, he was saying, as sort of proof that he wanted to buy the puppy. And that he said that scammers were really obvious, that when they asked for video proof via a WhatsApp call, he said the people would come up with some crackers of excuses, including one which was, my baby threw my phone at the wall and it bounced against the table, damaging both cameras, so I can't show you the dog. Basically, he said that the scammers were so rife that he ended up getting his dog called Hugo from Wales, from someone that he did trust, that was able to show him both the mother and the father of the puppy and do video calls and do the proper procedures. So yeah, some really lovely feedback and lovely dog pictures that we've had from you guys this last week. And I would love to see more. If you have got any more puppies, please do send them my way, because I do not have a lockdown puppy or a puppy of any kind, and they have made me very happy.
It wasn't just pictures of dogs that we got in the inbox this week, Amit, was it? We got something all the more creative.
Yeah, that's right. So Rob wrote in about a story that we did on corporate Memphis, which is the design style that's taken over the startup world. He mentions a few potential reasons in the email why this might be happening that we didn't mention in the article. So he thinks we're getting more aware of bad stock photography, so companies are moving away from that, and the fact that vector files are much easier to customize with your own brand colors, but kind of lead to all these designs looking quite similar. But the main thing that Rob did was he designed an amazing corporate Memphis-style image of the podcast team congratulating us on our 500th episode, which I think is better than our actual logo. It was really, really cool. So thank you for that, Rob. Yeah, we were genuinely I loved it.
It was lovely.
Yeah, it was
really
nice.
It was so accurate as well. I have that outfit.
Matt Burgess's clothes, he had absolutely nailed somehow, even despite probably only ever seeing our headshots. So it was brilliant.
It's always fun to talk about something that people can't see.
Yeah, I'd love to see more fan art. So if you want to send us some more fan art, podcast@wired.co.uk for lovingly hand-drawn pictures of us all and dog pictures.
Please do. Rob, we'll check with you if we're allowed to use the picture, and we'll maybe put it out on we haven't been back in touch. We'll maybe put it out on Twitter next week, once we check with you that it's okay to use it. It is very, very impressive indeed, although I think our creative director would probably disagree that it's better than our existing artwork, just in case he's listening.
Yeah, don't tell Andrew.
Thanks very much for listening, as always, and for all of your dog pictures and creative artwork. Feels a bit like an episode of Blue Peter. Please do keep sending them in. Thanks so much for listening. We'll see you again next week. Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.